Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, even though sometimes it feels counterintuitive, like the nightingale, a bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist. Thank you for joining me today. I can't believe we're in October already and heading for yet another eclipse season. There's a solar eclipse on the 14th and a lunar eclipse on the 28th. Now, astrologers will tell you these are powerful events and that eclipses come along to take the wheel and course correct where necessary. We can but hope, because I've noticed a couple of trends highlighted in the media lately that could do with some course correction. Now, later we'll be hearing from friend of the show, Professor James Goodwin, talking about the difference between brain health and mental health. But first, what of these trends, I hear you say? Well, first of all, I was dismayed, I think that's the right word anyway, to read this week that people are turning to more ultra-processed foods as prices continue to rise, because processed food is cheaper. So basically, people in the UK are eating less healthily to save money. It was a BBC Good Food Nation survey, and apparently they surveyed more than 2,000 adults across the country to find that while 69% considered themselves healthy eaters, 28% were eating less nutritious food because nutritious food or better food was too expensive. 19% were eating more ready meals and processed food because they were cheaper. And 17% weren't cooking as much from scratch. They also found that people are cutting back on organic ingredients and eating less protein because of the cost. Now, this saddens me because even with the rising cost of energy in the home, we can prepare good, nutritious and very often organic food relatively cheaply. I know, too, that the argument is that people don't have the time to spend on cooking, but I've always questioned this. Cooking something simple from scratch, simple and nutritious from scratch, can take even less time than a ready meal, and batch cooking helps save on the fuel costs. And that simple and tasty meal doesn't have to cost the earth. We just have to think about it a bit more. So much can be done with good yet inexpensive ingredients. Maybe we need an old-fashioned information campaign to help people shop for and cook healthy food that won't drain our health or our money reserves. Another concerning trend came to my notice this week. Knowing of my keen interest in gut health, health and well-being writer Linda Hamilton Parker brought a study from the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles to my attention. Investigators there found that lifestyle changes made during the COVID-19 pandemic could have led to changes in our gut biome. We're talking about things like the increased use of disinfectants and washing our hands much more often. They say that their findings suggest that these lifestyle changes may have inadvertently influenced the microbial composition of the small bowel, that's the small intestine, which is known to be highly influenced by lifestyle practice. Well, if you want to read more about this study, you'll find Linda's article at her website, onlynatural.uk. That's only-natural.uk. They say these changes to the microbiome could impact our general health, but I'd argue they definitely will. The increased use of antibacterials is bound to affect the bacteria within our bodies, as well as on our skin and in our environment. Our gut flora is hugely impactful on how our bodies function, and we tend to pay little enough attention to it as it is. This took me back to an interview I did earlier this year with Aliza Magori, the founder of the supplements brand Inessa. I put it to her at that time that many people still don't understand gut health and how to nurture it. So many people think that just eating a live yogurt regularly is enough to keep us healthy. And here's what Aliza said in reply.
Well, I mean, the effects of countless. We don't even know how many different types of live bacteria there are. We've not even isolated all of those. Mm. But the ones that have been studied and shown to have different effects within the body.
Yeah.
And so that's why if you have a specific health concern, specific types of bacteria can have a benefit. Whereas if you're having a live yogurt, of course that's helpful. Of course that's beneficial to us. But it's not going to have the same effect if you've got, for example, Lactobacillus rhamnosus. We've talked about that before. Mm. LGG, so Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG, that's the full name. So that one's been really well studied in skin issues. So it's been shown to help with eczema. It's also been studied and shown to help with to support immunity, particularly in children. So all of them act slightly differently, and it's kind of knowing which strains to work with that have an impact, you know, on a specific health need rather than just kind of, you know, live yogurt or fermented foods, which are super important. They are incredibly important. If you incorporate them into your diet, then that's
absolutely
great. That's a really nice natural way of getting probiotics. And I also don't think that everyone needs to take probiotics. I think you only need them if you've got a specific health need. You should be getting, you know, you should be nurturing your gut microbiome via diet where possible. So increasing diversity of the plant foods that you eat, that's been shown to be really, really crucial to kind of helping to maintain a healthy microbiome. And, you know, fermented foods and kind of things like yogurt are, you know, part of that as well. But not everyone needs to take a probiotic. It's just, you know, when you do take one, you shouldn't just be, you know, you might not benefit from just taking just anything, any specific strain that you might have just picked up off the shelf.
Yes. And I think that's where people get confused because, you know, we're told so often that, you know, live yogurt is so very good for you, which it is, you know, things like kombucha, kraut, you know, raw kraut, fermented cabbage, it's very good for you, which it is. Mixing all of those up in your diet are extremely good for you. Yep. However, they're not necessarily going to rectify something that's going on in your gut because it might not be the right culture to do that. It might not be the right thing. Yeah. So I guess then the advice would be to go and see a specialist, somebody like you who can actually identify what might be going on and what might be the better strains to take.
And actually some doctors are starting to get really interested in that area as well. So we actually have, we've had a lot of doctors over the past 2 years, I would say, that have started coming to us and asking for more information about our products, either because one of their own patients has come to them and said, I've been using this product and it's really helped me. So it's piqued their interest and they've gone, okay, I want to learn a little bit more about that. But I think that looking at health as a whole is becoming much more mainstream now. So they're looking at diet and they're looking at, you know, possibly using supplements in some cases. And I think that's great personally. It's just, you know, it's a change, and I think it's a shift in the way that modern medicine is working to look at, you know, obviously the amazing tools that we have that are life-saving as part of the kind of mainstream medical system, but also looking at diet and lifestyle and how important that is to actually maintain health. And, you know, like you said earlier, prevention is better than the cure, so they're starting to work from that perspective too.
Yes, there's a lot more to it, and I'm glad more medics are starting to study this area of health more thoroughly. If you don't have a specific condition and just want to maintain a healthy gut, there are plenty of foods that will help you. Some are fermented foods like sauerkraut and kimchi, or drinks like kefir and kombucha. Now, kefir can either be made with milk or water. I prefer the water kefir and used to make my own. These days, I make my own kombucha, which is much less expensive than buying it, and really not that difficult. Other fermented foods include miso, made from soya beans, and of course, yogurt will help too. Your gut will love olive oil, or any food full of fatty acids and polyphenols, in fact, and also non-fermented vegetables like peas, Brussels sprouts, garlic, and ginger. They will all help. Plus bananas. They're also full of the kind of fibre your gut bacteria enjoy. And there are lots of other foods that will help you in your gut. I've put together a longer list on my blog at thepracticalalchemist.uk to save you a bit of an internet trawl. Go and check that out. One thing we do now understand is how our brains are affected by the health of our gut biome. And that's something today's guest, Professor James Goodwin, knows all about. Regular listeners might know that James is Director of Science and Research Impact at the Brain Health Network. He's one of the world's foremost experts on brain health and the author of the book Supercharge Your Brain. He also knows a lot about the effects of ageing, as he was Chief Scientific Officer at Age UK and at one time advised the Centre for Better Ageing in London on their research. Dr. Goodwin shares some interesting facts about the microorganisms we all host in our bodies, particularly in the context of brain health. It's common to conflate brain health with mental health, so I started off today's chat by asking him what is the difference between the two. You'll hear his answer in a moment, but first we'll take a short break to hear these messages from our station sponsors.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station, with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist. And today's guest is the brain health expert, Professor James Goodwin. So many people confuse brain health with mental health, but what is the difference? Here's Dr. Goodwin.
I think we have to identify each one in turn and then compare them and contrast them to identify that difference. We talk about brain health first. Brain health is all about the state of functioning of the cells, the tissues in this wonderful organ, the brain, and how well it's doing. We can answer how well is it doing by looking at what I call three pillars of brain health, which in effect is answering three questions. The first one would be, how well am I thinking? How good is your reason? How is your logic doing? What about your executive skills and making decisions or calculating? How is your learning or your memory? That's the first pillar, how well am I thinking? The second one is, how well am I interacting with others? And this we call social cognition. It's an entirely human behavior, which is why I've been quite critical about lockdown policies, because inherently we are social animals, and no social animal throughout the animal kingdom does well if it's isolated. And humans have sufficiently high levels of consciousness to perceive loneliness, as do many primates. So social cognition is really important to humans, and that's the really important second question. How well am I interacting with others? The third one is, how well do I feel? That's all about our sense of well-being and our emotional balance. So on the one hand, we have positive emotions such as joy, elation, and pleasure, largely from the left side of the brain, not exclusively. And in contrast to that, we have negative emotions like anger, fear, and rage, largely from the right side of the brain. And if we can balance those emotions, then our subjective perception of how we feel will be good and well balanced. If we ask what is brain health, you've also got to ask what's brain illness. And scientists define brain illness not just in the absence of disease, but in terms of how well the brain is functioning globally. Brain disease is neurodegenerative. In other words, it normally comes because the cells and tissues of the brain don't work well. Examples: Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, diseases of movement like the Couriers or the dystonias, is where muscle tone is badly affected. They will be examples of brain disease. Now, JJ, would you like me now to talk about mental health or mental illness?
Well, yes, but what I was going to ask you about, because I think that's a great explanation. However, you talk about emotions still in terms of brain health. And I would have thought that that would have come under mental health as a distinction.
Yeah. We talk about emotions because they are a way in of working out how well the brain is functioning.
Okay, right.
So there's an overlap here between how we tell that the organic matter of the brain is doing okay, on the one hand, and on the other hand, how is our mind working? Now, okay. Mind is the product of the chemistry, if you like, or the physiology of the brain. And as we talked before the show, neuroscientists have this expression, no consciousness in the absence of organic material. So our mind is the product of how the brain cells, tissues, and the organ itself is working. Mind is manifested in how we think, how we feel, how we perceive our environment, how we behave. It's distinct from the chemical operations of the brain, but it's a product of it.
Right. Understood. Yeah, that makes it clear. Yeah. Yes. And so then mental health, thank you very much for that explanation, further explanation.
Sure.
Mental health then is what?
Mental health, or the absence of mental health, mental illness, are identified conditions of behavior or cognition. And in the case of mental illness, whether they cause significant distress or impairment of personal functioning. So I'll give you some examples. So if an individual has got low mood, low self-esteem, poor motivation or bad energy levels, doesn't sleep well and has poor concentration, and that goes on persistently for more than 2 weeks, that warrants a diagnosis of depression. Another example would be if you have got uncontrollable levels of anxiety which impair your relationships with others, your activities of daily living, your work, and so on, and that goes on for more than 6 months, then that warrants a diagnosis of anxiety. The difference between depression and anxiety is there's only one diagnosis of depression, but there are many different diagnoses of anxiety. So, for example, you could have a phobia, which is a form of anxiety, and there are many phobias. There is a condition called generalized anxiety disorder. But generally speaking, anxiety is much more diverse disability than is depression. Depression, JJ, is a good case in point, because we can have organic depression and non-organic depression. What's the difference between the two? Well, organic depression is where we can identify things actually physically going wrong in the brain, either disorder of transmitted substances, chemical imbalance, and that would give rise to the depression. Could even be a tumor. Could be a pathology going on in the brain, a neuropathology. And that is organic depression. We can relate the depression, the signs and symptoms that we see, to something physical that's going on in the brain. Now, there's non-organic depression, which is when a person exhibits all the symptoms that I identified, such as low mood, low self-esteem, and so on, and we can't relate it to something we can find going on in the brain. Now, my own view is there is something going wrong in the brain, we just can't detect it.
Interesting, yeah. Interesting. Well, our brain doesn't exist in isolation. So, you know, something's going on there, or mind doesn't exist in isolation. So obviously there must be something going on, but it surely is a case of all kinds of different emotional factors and other factors affecting mood and affecting how we relate to the world around us, surely.
Yeah, there are multiple causes for a disorder of the mind. On the one hand, you would have genetics. We know that there are some genes or alleles, one allele from your mum, one allele from your dad. We know there are alleles which contribute to depression, or narcissism is another example. But there are many environmental causes which cause the balance of the mind to be disturbed. And these can be family breakdown, abuse, neglect, bullying, yeah. trauma,
yeah.
accidents, the experience of crime or poor treatment by others, bullying, sustained stress. Everyone has their limit beyond which dire consequences can ensue in the balance of the mind. So these are environmental causes. There are also behavioral causes like drug use,
yeah.
alcohol consumption, overconsumption of caffeine. I noticed I noticed there was a nutritional supplement in the United States for bodybuilders and weightlifters that's been withdrawn from the market under the orders of the FDA because it was tested and found to give people a dose twice a day, two drinks a day, 10 grams of caffeine. 10 grams of caffeine is not a good idea.
Wow.
So, you know, all kinds of toxic materials can be absorbed by the body through the air we breathe, the food we eat, or even by skin contact.
Yeah.
Which can affect the physiology of the brain and can produce mental ill health.
And hormonal imbalances as well, presumably.
Yes. So when the physiology of the body starts to go wrong, if you have any form of abnormal physiology where the range of changes in the physiology of the body is beyond what we would normally expect for good health, that will contribute to mental health problems too. And also illnesses. Comorbidity, especially in middle age, if you start to get chronic long-term conditions in middle age, that really can contribute towards mental ill health. Interestingly, mental ill health is less prevalent over the age of 70 than it is in middle age. Isn't that interesting?
Well, I'll look forward to being over 70 in that case. I think that's another thing going for old age, in my opinion. But I don't want to be flippant about this because it is important. And we were talking again earlier before we started recording this. We were talking about all the great ancient philosophers. And of course, they all used to focus on the mind, the brain. But what has only recently come to the fore is the issue of gut health and the brain, which you know, all the old philosophers wouldn't have known anything about. That wouldn't have really come into their minds at all. So, and some people call the gut our other brain or another brain. Sure. But tell us a little bit about the connection between the gut and the brain.
I will, but your opening remark about the great philosophers of history is well made. Many of them, our brain, gives us the capacity to analyze our own minds. And they did it with aplomb.
Mm.
You've only got to consider, we talked about the Oxford degree, the greats, which is an analysis of the great thinkers of all time. And it's still probably one of the most difficult academic courses in the world. those philosophers had great insights, but where it all changed was the European Enlightenment, where empirical science started to produce a greater awareness of the biology, the physiology, and the evolution of humanity. And one of those findings in recent times is the finally integrated relationship between what's going on in our digestive system and the brain. Well, how has this come about? In early evolution, before there were even any primates in the world, there was a massive interaction between microorganisms and every other animal and plant life on the planet. In fact, we have a virus in our bodies that in an evolutionary sense is hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years old. It's been incorporated into our genes and is responsible still for the normal development of the embryo. I mean, I find that astonishing.
It is astonishing, yeah.
So in coming from the primates, which had a well-defined digestive system, and any other lower animals do, we could always expect to find microorganisms in there.
Yeah.
Bacteria, virus, and some fungi. And these microorganisms are more in number in terms of their cells than the cells of the human body. So we're only 43% human, if you like.
I know. Yeah, that number always gets me. We do tend to think of ourselves as a single organism, but we really are not. So much of our systems isn't even us. Well, while we all digest that, let's take a short break. We'll be back with more from Professor James Goodwin after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ Stenhouse, the practical alchemist, and my guest today, Professor James Goodwin. And we were talking about all the microorganisms that call our bodies home.
These microorganisms are very important in the gut. And I think it was about 1995. Forgive me if I can't remember the name right. I think the professor was called Mark Light, L-Y-T-E. And he discovered that if he took some sterile mice, so from birth they'd been growing up in a sterile environment treated with antibiotics, and he found that if you put a bacterium called Campylobacter into germ-free mice, their anxiety levels rose. And then if you took another group of mice and you put a bacteria in their digestive system, or lactobacillus, that anxiety levels went down.
Yeah.
Astonishing. This is the first finding that in mammals, which have a lot of physiology common to us, bacteria in their guts, which was changing their emotions and their state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's believed that, well, not believed, but known, that the chemistry of microorganisms is vastly important to the brain. I'll give you an example. One of the most important transmitter substances in the brain is called serotonin, and yet the brain only makes about 10% of it. So that's really interesting, a molecule which is essential for the stability of our emotions in the brain. Only 10% of it is made there. Where does the rest come from? 90% of it from the bacteria in our digestive systems.
So from the bacteria in our digestive systems, not as a byproduct of digestion itself, but directly from the bacteria.
The bacteria are fermenting away, feeding on the food that we eat and that we give them.
Yeah.
And as a part of that, they produce serotonin amongst many other millions of molecules.
Wow.
The bacteria help the immune system to mature by forming a bacterial gel or a layer around the inside of the gut, which stops any toxins, many toxins, and many harmful microorganisms from leaving the gut and going into our bloodstream. They're absolutely essential to our immune system. And the immune system operates on transmitter substances. Serotonin is a transmitter substance, and it's vital to the balance of our emotions in the brain. It's thought that some mental disorders can be put right by changing the balance of microorganisms in the gut. So in the 4th century, there was a Chinese doctor called Gi Hong, and he produced this malodorous mixture called yellow broth, which is made from human feces.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yellow broth. And he used to feed this to people.
Yeah.
Well, that's gone on in medieval medicine and even in Victorian medicine.
Yeah.
Now you can get a capsule
mm-hmm.
with human feces in, which is perfectly well balanced. It's an impermeable capsule. You swallow it, it goes down into the large intestine, and then it reseeds the gut with new mm-hmm. microorganisms. It's called microbial fecal transplantation,
yeah.
MFT.
Mm-hmm.
And it's commonly used. It's used in autism.
Yes.
It's used in obesity. If you see an obese person, it isn't just because that person is stuffing their face with donuts all day. Right. It might be because of the balance of microorganisms in their digestive system. This is hugely sophisticated and difficult biochemistry and microbiology. But there are therapies now for treating a number of conditions that we have as humans by treating the microbiome. It's interesting to note 50% of all people with irritable bowel syndrome, in which there's inevitably an imbalance of microorganisms, have anxiety and depression.
Yes. And I absolutely believe that. And I take a supplement every day myself, a biotic complex, it's called. And it's a lot stronger than many of the other probiotics that you can, and prebiotics that you can buy over the at the chemist or wherever. And but I have to tell you that it absolutely has sorted out any issues that I might have had as a result of my gut flora not working properly.
I'm not surprised. There are prebiotics and probiotics. Prebiotics. Yeah. Everybody should eat a diet high in prebiotics. In other words, plant fiber.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Everybody should eat a diet high in those. Otherwise, you're starving the microbes in the gut.
Exactly.
If you eat refined food all the time, the standard American diet, pizzas, burgers, fries, takeaways, you know, even pre-prepared curries and things like that, they've got virtually no prebiotic fiber in them or polyphenols.
Yeah, none. Yeah,
and you've got to feed the microbes. If you don't feed the microbes, are you going to get a mental illness? No, but it won't help. You're not inevitably not going to, you know, have a mental condition, but it won't help. If you pay attention to your diet, it's going to have a massive effect on your state of mind. JJ, interestingly, Forbes magazine, which many of your listeners will be familiar with, a couple of years ago wrote an article called "Microbes That Blow the Mind," and they said that we are now living in the decade of the microbiome. Certainly in the US, there are hundreds of companies now trying to find therapies or psychotropic molecules that bacteria make by treating treating our gut. Psychobiotics is the name of the game these days.
Wow. So interesting, isn't it? And, you know, I think like many people when I was younger, I used to have a very simplistic view of digestion. You know, I thought that I ate food. And this is what we were taught. You ate food. Yeah. It was broken down in your gut. Not really, you know, very clear about how that happened. It was enzymes and stuff and things that, you know, broke down your food. And then the goodness out of your food passed through your gut into your blood, you know, and then you were, you know, your body was basically fed all the nutrients it needed. Such a simplistic approach as we know now.
Yeah.
It's
digestion and the digestive system is hugely complex.
Yeah.
And hugely vital. 70% of the immune system of the body is found in the digestive system. Why? Because we take objects from the outside world. We call it food. We take this material and we put it in our mouths and swallow it. So anything that was on that material in the outside world goes straight into our digestive system. If the body had no way of defending itself against this invasion of foreign material, whether it's the materials themselves or the microorganisms on it, if we had no way of dealing with that, we would never have survived.
Mm.
And I've really got to look after our gut. It's almost a case for saying, if you look after your gut, you'll go a long, long way to looking after your state of mind and the brain. And I'll go back to the original statement, no consciousness in the absence of organic material. If you're not looking after the brain material, then you're going to have a difficult time staying free from mental illness. And that includes degenerative conditions like Alzheimer's, which you get in later life. I mean, preventative medicine, JJ, is so, so important to look after the brain and the mind.
No, it is. It is. And as some people who listen regularly to the show will know, I've had a lifelong struggle to bring my gut biome into some kind of, not even just balance, but you know, a state where it's properly working.
Sure.
After a difficult birth, not being breastfed, and then being a sickly child and having antibiotics all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which just compounded it. Sickly child, antibiotic, more sickly child, more antibiotics. Sure. And so, and of course, nobody understood the connections in those days. So it's been a bit of a lifelong journey of discovery for me to get to a point where I now know absolutely, you know, how it all works and what I need to do about it.
Sure. JJ, I was asked a question on the BBC,
mm-hmm.
which really made me think. And that was, can we image the brain and find out whether there's any mental illness likely from what we see?
Ooh.
What a great question that was.
Mm. And that made me think. Can we? Can we do that?
Well, it's a great story. So the first experiment, imaging the brain and looking at a mental condition, which was schizophrenia, carried out in 1976. So what? That's almost 50 years ago, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
That experiment was done to see if it would help, imaging the brain would help in diagnosis and treatment. Okay, so where have we got with it? Well, it's now widely used to exclude organic brain disease as a source of mental illness. So imaging the brain allows us to look at tumours, any circulatory conditions in the arteries and vessels, and whether there's any inflammation there. And it's useful where you've got underlying neuropathology. So there's a disease going on in there. It'll pick it up. Now, here's the great story. 1976, it really wasn't a lot of help other than what I've mentioned in identifying mental illness. Well, how about this now? With an improvement in the imaging techniques like functional MRI, PET, PET scanning, and artificial intelligence, if you put images of the brain in front of a computer, 90% of the time it can distinguish between a schizophrenic brain and a normal brain.
Really?
Yeah. That's astonishing. 67% of the time it can distinguish between a person with a bipolar condition, manic depression, right, and a normal brain. And 88% of the time, it can distinguish between a schizophrenic brain and a bipolar brain. Well, that's all going in the right direction, isn't it?
Wow.
So although NICE won't recommend brain scanning as a means of detecting mental illness, they soon will. What do I mean by soon? A couple of decades.
Yeah.
So a couple of decades down the road, they'll be able to image the brain and have a pretty good idea what the cause of the mental illness is. Now, before I came on your show...
Just to say, for anybody who doesn't know, NICE, of course, is the body which polices these things and says whether we can or cannot have certain drugs, you know, what drugs are appropriate for what conditions and that sort of thing.
It's largely done on a cost-benefit relationship. So in other words, if it's going to cost £3 million a week to treat somebody and they're going to have a 5% improvement, they won't recommend it.
Mm.
I mean, that's an extreme example, but I hope your listeners get the point from that.
Yeah.
And of course, they're on an extremely emotional ground there, because why should my partner of 30 years not have treatment because it's £50,000 a shot?
Mm.
You know, if it'll only save one life. Wow, they are really excruciating ethical arguments.
Arguments which aren't necessarily had in the USA, where...
If you can afford it in the USA, you'll get it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But the same principle applies here as in the USA. No such thing as free medicine. Free at the point of delivery. Brilliant idea. I'm all for that.
Yeah.
But actually, medicine is hugely important. When I go to America, it brings home to me what people in Britain do not see. For example, a ride in an ambulance from a road accident in the US, that'll cost you upwards of $1,000.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But that's the real cost of it. You think about the capital costs of the ambulance, the equipment inside, the training of the professionals, the experience you've got, the safety you have, even possibly a minor operation in that ambulance at the scene, right? £1,000 a ride in an ambulance, right? Now, everyone takes that for granted in Britain.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying it to advocate one system or the other. What I'm saying is medicine is extremely expensive, and the more science that goes into it and the more technology that goes into it, the more expensive it's going to be. And people will want it, because what costs $50,000 today will cost $5,000 in the future. That's how it works.
Yeah, it is. It is. Wow. So we're getting to a point where, and AI is involved in us being able to distinguish between these things in the brain. Where's it going to
AI
stop?
AI is being used exclusively in medicine.
Mm.
There's a judgment call to be made as how far do we trust artificial intelligence coming to the correct diagnosis.
Yeah, this is always going to be my question, is how far do you trust it?
Medicine has increasingly trusted technology in coming to conclusions about diagnoses and treatment. Mm. When the thermometer was first introduced in the, I believe it was the 19th century, doctors dismissed it and said there will never be a replacement for the touch of the doctor's hand on the brow of the patient.
Right. Okay.
That's what they said. Now they can't get enough technology.
Yeah. And now you're not using thermometers with mercury, and you're using all kinds of other forms.
Yeah. If someone said to me, would I have an operation on my brain by a robot as opposed to a surgeon every time? Because a surgeon can only cut to an accuracy of 1 millimeter with a scalpel.
Oh, I see what you mean, yeah.
Right? Mm. A robot, 1/10 of a millimeter, right? That 1 millimeter is my sense of humor gone.
Yeah.
And that's how they conduct brain operations now. The patient is awake. And they have a psychologist, a clinical psychologist, talking to the patient. Can you put words together? Do you recognize these? What's a zebra? Can you describe a motorcycle? You mean all these questions are going on as the operation's taking place. So the psychologist is saying to the surgeon, confusion in the meanings of words is beginning to come in. So the surgeon then knows I can't go much further. Otherwise, you know, they'll lose it.
Well, I thank you very much for talking to us today about brain health. And I hope that you never have to go through surgery on the brain. And I hope I never do. And anybody listening to this does, because it sounds horrendous. But I hear what you're saying about if you had to undergo it, then you would prefer a robot because of that precision that a robot can offer. Yeah. But apart from that, really interesting, fascinating, once more, thank you so, so much. I think it'll have cleared up a lot of things for people today, sure. I think, about mental health and brain health. Yeah. So, yeah, really grateful to you for that. And
a great book, which your listeners might need to know about, is called Do No Harm by a surgeon called Morton, I believe, but you can find it on Google.
Yeah.
That is an absolute stunner, which really, in lucid terms, explains the difference between what's going on in the brain and what's going on in your mind.
Brilliant. Well, I might have to read that myself. Thank you very much for that tip. And hopefully you'll come back and talk to us again another time about more sure. things to do with brain and health. But for now, thank you so much for everything today. It's been really fascinating. Thank you.
A pleasure, JJ.
And if you haven't heard any of Professor Goodwin's previous interviews on brain health, I do recommend them. Now, he's been a regular guest on the show for a while, so do go back and check out some of the other things that he's talked about in terms of brain health and mental health. He's absolutely brilliant in really simplifying a very complex area. So, yeah, go and check those out. But for now, we're sadly coming to the end of the show. I hope you've enjoyed it and maybe even given you pause for thought over your food and lifestyle choices. I know it has for me. Talking of choices, you have a choice as to where you listen to UK Health Radio these days. You can listen to our shows on all the main podcast platforms now. And if you like what you hear, or if they've helped you, we'd love it if you would help us spread the word by sharing the shows. Also, if you haven't already, check out the show I co-host with psychiatrist and coach Dr. Mark Goulston here on UK Health Radio. It's called Hurt Less, Live More, and Mark and I share experiences, anecdotes and wisdom with some great guests. We laugh a lot and we cry a lot, all in a good way, and we'd love you to join us. And if you want more information on health and well-being, you can head over to my website. It's thepracticalalchemist.uk. Subscribe to my newsletter to be the first to get some great content, or find me as The Practical Alchemist on Instagram and Facebook. And then, of course, there's also Health Triangle magazine, and you can subscribe to that at ukhealthradio.com. Thank you for listening today. Join me for more alchemy here on UK Health Radio another time. Until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.